Accession number 17987, Reel 3.
Mr. Vincent, Reel 3.
The bridge across the Nactong was, as I said, Carly floats tied together. Some were perforated at different angles, and you know, they were strung together with this perforated aerodrome strips. They used to make landing fields with it, laid down like metal strips, perforated, locked together. Anyway, they linked together edgeways and just laid across the top of these things, and a rope went across. And one of my mortar numbers, Jake Much, it was being shelled by some gun way out outside it was. And the lad in front of me, he was hit by a piece of shrapnel, and luckily he got over it, he's alive now. But he just grunted and sagged to his knees, and I just said, hang on, Greg, you know, somebody come along. And away we went, because you couldn't stop and help anybody, there was no room. And on we went, and there was American engineers the other side, and every bang where the gun went off, they jumped into foxholes, until an officer stood up and he said, stand up, Much, the best of life, and the welcome through. So that made us feel good. And away we went, and there's dead bodies of North Koreans in the ditches where they've been caught by the airplanes, you know. And on we went, and we eventually got in the area where 282 was. 282 was our first, what might you say, hand to hand bit, you know, come face to face with the enemy.
Is this a hill?
Hill 282, yes. That was its number. I just imagine that was its height number, you know. And on the road leading to it was a line of American Sherman tanks all pointing at this hill, and there was a small hill before it, and foothills to it, of course, but there's a river. The Yanks wouldn't go across the river, and we hadn't got any vehicles. We were good, so we carried everything that we wanted to do across the river. The rifle companies had gone ahead, and we carried our mortars to a position near the foothills to give them covering fire if needed. And then they were up there doing it. We could hear the radio reports about the fighting going on. And then these Mustangs came in, orders off of us, and we thought, well, someone's going to cop it, but we didn't know it was going to be in two of our companies. The Americans didn't bother looking their markings, or they didn't see them, but they did a lot of damage to A and C companies, which is in the regimental history and the other sort of things. Major Muir won his VC at the top there. My brother was wounded and he took no further part in the action, and we were mortared by a bigger weapon than a 3-inch. But we started looking for who it was. We started mortaring them, and when you're looking for a mortar, you shift your aim and try and find him different places. But he used to lob over bombs that knocked the heck out of the hill at the back of us, and it's comical. I'd give the order for 5 rounds rapid. The blokes would fire 5 rounds and jump in the slit trench and wait for him to have his turn, but he packed in first, so I don't know whether we found him or what. But he packed in, and then we got to know what had happened, and an American tank commander, he said to me, it's the first time I'm ashamed to be American, that we packed up and went across. And
Over what did he mean?
Over the Americans bombing the troops, because everybody had tried to tell them, but they weren't listening. Oh, Major, that's something, Major Muir. You know, so the nice blokes were there. One little fellow went to her, he was always cheerful, hello, a nice little fellow, cocky little job, you know, but he got a rocket all to himself in a slit trench. That different stories came out, and some of the first people to help the Argyles down the hill were Japanese settlers from the valley.
Japanese,
you know, could have been Japanese at one time. And that was another thing about the Japanese settlers. These four or five fellas that remembered the Japanese, they didn't mind the Japanese, but they detested the Koreans. And one of them told me, he said that prisoner of war camps were usually put under the command of some idiot who was unfit for active service. And as the Koreans couldn't be trusted in the front line of the Japanese army, they put him guarding POW camps. And most of them had taken Japanese names because they had spent some time, you know, under the Japanese rule. They said they're the so-and-so that did most of the damage. But as I said, they helped some of the lads down. And these fellas couldn't stand the Koreans near them. Every unit was supposed to have a section of Korean police as interpreters and stuff like that, and make sure you got on with the inhabitants, whatever. But these fellas used to with pickaxes and anything they could if they got within range, and they're taken off the Argyles eventually, you know, because they couldn't stand aside them. And anyway, we all gathered at Waeghorn, I think it was, waiting for reinforcements. And in the interim period, while we were waiting, as one of the companies was to go and look for some people that had been left behind, some of the Koreans had been left behind. And my section was detailed as water cover. And my sergeant, Paddy Sands, he was up with the rifle company, you know, as a mobile fire controller. He used to get orders from his company commander, who was with the troops. He used to relay back to me what I'd set up the mortars and carry on from there, you know, what fire was needed, what line was needed, such and such, and range. And then I'd see to it carried up. But we set up in his village and let him know where we were, and, you know. And then some little old lady came up and started talking to me in Korean. I couldn't understand a blind word, but luckily we had an interpreter, and he let me know that because it was near 282, just under 282, where the attacks were taking place. And it appears her son had been hit by one of the 50 caliber rounds that, I presume the 50 caliber had been hit by one of the rounds from the plane during the doings. Anyway, I said, well, bring him up, let's have a look at him. I thought he might have a scratch, you know. Anyway, his lad came out, young teenager. At a rough guess, as much as you can guess about the Oriental, about 12, 13. And he had his head all wrapped up, wasn't bandaged. And I undid it slowly. And then I looked, and there it was. He had, I swear, it was a 50 caliber right through the palm of his hand. So I thought, well, not much we can do here. So I bound it up with a bit more sterile dressing, you know. And I said, what we can do, I said, we'll take him back to our medical officer and he can see to it, you know, see to him and get him looked after. And when the Korean interpreter told the lady, you know, the old lady, it was almost embarrassing with her gratitude, you know. But she went away and she brought back a little bag of his stuff. And then when the action packed in, when the success or failure took place, you know, we got given orders to move back. We had Bren carriers that seen service in the northern desert. So you can imagine how old we were. Anyway, this lad, the only way to get him back was with us, so I sat him on my knee, and in the front of a brain carrier isn't the best of the places. You're bouncing up and down, feeling all the jerks, rough ground over the riverbed, and he never made a murmur. Gone all the way to the regimental aid post, where the battalion was, and handed him over to Doc the Jock, Jock the Doc, Mr. Haldane, as I had other work to do. And from then on, I never known what happened to him. I'd like to know, but there's not much chance of finding out. He'd be an old man now, anyway. And then, what happened then? Oh, the Yanks invaded Incheon, you know, landed at Incheon. And we... No. When memories are thin here. The big thing was we... There was a tank stuck in a ditches, you know, in the paddy fields. And the LAD came up and gave the Yanks a demonstration of pulling one out. Get an old Scammel, tied it to a tree, put the rope out and pulled the tank out, like pulling a cork out of a bottle. And the Yanks were amazed, you know, couldn't work it out. But anyway, the move came to get up to where the fighting was, headed for Incheon. We were taking the left-hand side of the country. The Yankee Marine Division was taking the right. And the battalion flew up to Kimpo Airport, I think it was, in Seoul, I think it's Kimpo. But we were to drive the trucks up there, and Renkai's with their crews were to go with them, obviously, all the MT. And the first night, we all lagered in a vast open space. We didn't know what it was because it was pitch black all around us. And we got down to it, and we... Two carriers I had to worry about was, bedded down. Got the lads bedded down, fed one thing like that. And next morning when we woke up, cold morning, and we couldn't start our carrier. I mean, something, you know, they had to be warmed up, they had to get the sun in it or something. But she wouldn't start. And I thought, well, this is handy. All the battalion left. Anyway, I looked round, and there's my mate, old Chip Cochran. He's sitting in the same boat, further up the track, you know, and he's in the same boat as I am. And then as it got lighter and lighter, there's two Australians further over, because the Australians had joined us by then, and they had two carriers of theirs, and they were motorman as well. So we got together, we got them all started, and we started after the battalion. And we're only guessing where we're going. Looking for Nottingham Forward signs all the time. And we got there. We got the first night of rations. We came to an American camp. And we stopped on an embankment of the road. And this camp, one of the lads went down to see if we'd get a meal. And Jack said, yeah, come down. So with that, all four brain carriers to the 90 degree turn and just came down the bank. Yanks were amazed. Tanks were no turrets. But we had a meal, and then further up the road, we came to a farm of white leghorns, I think they were, all white chickens. The Australians thought that was great. They'd never seen so many chickens on a carry in your whole life. But, another occasion, we're coming up the road and we're in a convoy. We got in with some supply convoy up the road. And one of the Australians who was leading, he pointed to the truck in front of him. And we could see it. Sea rations, you know, compact rations. So he's intimated by a series of doings he's going to climb up past the doings back. So we said, all right, you know, so we all crept up right behind the truck and kept ourselves tight, and he climbed up there and we obtained some rations. We won, relieved them, you know, relieved the weight of the truck kind of thing, and lobbed them back to the four carriers, and carried on. We eventually joined the battalion again. What happened then? I've never had any great doings. We started to chase. All the battalion met at Kaesong, and we had a big boost in speech from the general in command of Hong Kong in the Far East. Forget his name now, it's in the book, in the picture.
Not MacArthur?
No, not no, the British.
No, it's all right.
The British fella. You know, MacArthur, we didn't think much of him. His idea of fighting a war, charging up with drones. I think we were sent forward one action. I don't even remember General Dean, one of the first commanders in the American commando, captured with a lot of his men. And we were sent forward to, spearheading the race to get him. And they're dropping some paratroopers in front to stop him. stop the train taking him up. Paratroopers missed the train. We came up. And it was snowing by then. That's this particular action. It was snowing. There's snow on the ground. And there's some huts alongside each side of the road. And the place was crawling with American paratroopers doing their macho stuff. And we're sat in the carriers waiting for further orders. And an Australian came up, looked shuffling along with his slouch hat and great coat on, his rifle over his shoulder, and started yakking. He said, "What's the matter, mate? Is he cold, you know?" So with that, set the thatch on fire in one of the huts. And joined the heat. And an American officer came out and said, "You can't do that. It's against the Geneva Conventions and that." And he got some of his men up on the roof. There they are, trying to put the fire out with snowballs. And the Australian watched them for a little while. Then he walked across the road, put a match to another one. He said, "Hey, there's another one on fire over here." With that, we got orders to move, so I don't know what happened to them after that.
That was during your attempt to recapture General Dean.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. The Americans missed him, and we was no point in us mucking about. But get back to Khe Sanh, we got the usual rousing speech from the general and one another, commander of Far East, and off we started with the dust in the summer. It's beyond belief when you're in a convoy or going up a road at speed, and that seemed to be the idea. Now advance to contact as fast as we can. And it's surprising the distances. On one time we covered 30 miles in one day. Never saw enemy of any kind. Got to a place called Sariwan, which was supposed to be in the Aldershot of North Korea. And on the skyline above the town was a T-34, the Russian tank, which the Americans dreaded. And they weren't going to go in there with their tanks. They didn't want to argue with them. So they held back, and A Company went forward. And my section was giving covering fire with them. And we fired in the action, and we did a decent job. We were quite pleased with us at the end. And eventually the Americans decided to go forward when their company took the town, because the T-34 had probably been knocked out by fights anyway. But as they were going by, they were going the old big gung-ho things in the tanks, and we're chucking apples, not to them, but at them, because the Korean villagers came out with big boxes of apples, and we were doing our best at the Yanks in the trucks, in the tanks and that. We didn't get in a great deal with them. But we had, it's funny enough, with the Yanks, we had a 2nd Chemical Battalion, C Company, funny enough. A C Company, 2nd Chemical Battalion, and they were 4.2 mortars. And they were attached to us, the Argyles. And we mucked down great with them being mortars as well. And they used to tell us we're staying with you because you wouldn't leave us like the army of ours would. They said you wouldn't pull out and leave us. They said they would. But and we got on great with them. And Paddy's on as the sergeant. Yeah, we were in one position, it was frozen. 4.2 miles with us. And this sergeant, and the staff sergeant, I think he was, in the American Army, he said, "What would I have to do to be like you blokes, old buddy?" He looked at him, he said, "Let's see your rifle." There, he got a rifle. He said, "I bust it to a private straight away." He said, "Your bloody rifle's a disgrace, you know." He said, "You're an accident." He said, "That might have to save your life." He said, "I'll wave you down to a private, you know." And there's one occasion when I saw Major Snow, the American company chief, and he got a big Negro truck driver with him, and he said, "I want you to dig a slit here and cover down the road with your Bratton automatic rifle." And the American, he looked at the frozen ground, he looked at the words, he kicked the ground. He said, "You can go and kiss my big black ass," and he walked away. I thought, crikey, what an army. Tell a major to do that. Well, anyway, we got on well with them. They were quite happy with us. And when we left Korea, Major Snow was standing at the crossroads crying. And he got the KYSBs in our place, so we didn't do bad. The next action was we took Sorry One, all right, and we carried on to different places, small brushes. Borders weren't in action much, but we got to Cheongju, I think, near the border, and American newsmen came around. We were sitting, loafing about the carriers waiting for further orders. You never went far from your carriers, just in case something else blew up. And we're sitting there, and this American came up. He said to one of the lads, "Throw a grenade in there," which was in the slit trench under the house, "and see if you get somebody out, see if there's anybody in there, and stand there with your rifle." I said to the bloke, "You leave it alone." I said, "Keep the grenade where it is." I said, "You might need it later." I said, "You go and pick, you take your picture of the Yanks, you know." I didn't like the idiots trying to make something good, because we once saw General Walker, I think that was his name. Anyway, he's a big general in the American Army. He was shooting chickens with a carbine. And they were sorting the Stars and Stripes. General fighting the war. So I thought, blimey, you know, no wonder they keep him there. That's why MacArthur had such a big, you know, group of people with him, always all photographers and reporters. But anyway, Cheongju was about as far as we got with the mortars. We pushed on a little bit further, I think, when we came down. Then the Chinese got in the argument, and with that, it was non-stop down, as Major Slim told, or General Slim, as he is now, told the meeting of the Koreans, Argyle Show, you know, the association, to dinner. He said, "Well, less said about them, the better, the Americans," he said, "because all I'll say is we led them all the way up to the Yellow River and we followed them all the way down, because we were the rear guard. Don't let anybody kid you about we're not. We were got down to one position. We were going up in one place. We were going forward. And the Yanks were pouring down alongside us going the other way. And we had got to this ridge. And we were supposed to hold it. Oh, we got, before then, we got cut off at Pachon. Chinese headquarters, you know. We were cut off. A company was one side. And the rest of the battalion was the other. And, with the river at the back of us, the buildings, and on the other, mortars were set up. We opened up on minimum range of 550, and we stretched them out, pushed them back to maximum range. And A Company was fighting from the other side, and there's that many that side that we lost a good sergeant there, Nobby Clark. He got it. Damn good fella. But we got out. We didn't do too bad there. And we got back there and carried on down. It was a bit dodgy for us one particular time, because we were one of the last carriers to leave. And we got just a part of the way down the road, and that carrier packed in, you know, just about clapped out. But he said to the driver, "What the hell's the matter with it?" "I don't know," he said, you know. Eventually found out, water, lack of water. I said, "What the hell are we going to do now? You got no water." With that, we could hear the popping of this old Russian truck coming down the road. I said to the blokes, "Get ready for crying out loud, we don't know what this is." And it came around the corner, an old Muscovite truck or whatever it was, but the Australians were there. And they said, "What the hell are you doing, you know?" And I said, "We're out of water." He said, "Oh, we got you some." You know. So they had some water with us, and we got water, and we got on the move again. But pretty good, you know. We got back and joined the rest of the battalion. Different things came down. It was like my son, he said, when would the Seoul Olympics run? He'd see all the lights on the TV and pretty coloured river and money and that. I said, "Do you ever cross that river, Dad?" I said, "Yeah, about four times, and there wasn't the lights in sight." But we came out. If you cross the river, you got wet in the carrier, because they've got a sump hole to drain water out. And long since have the screw pieces been lost. And they've also got a starting handle hole in the front, and that's covered long been gone. So consequently, the co-driver is trying to do two things at once and rupture yourself in the process, trying to bung up two holes with his feet. You have to always do it. But we used to get down there, and then just started the war. The 25 pounders came in. We were in this position on the big pull out. We got this position, in this position, and told us to hold it for 4 hours at all costs. And if the Chinese hit us, we were to take our base sights and base plugs away with us, you know, and get gone, walk it, you know, took all the transport and everything away. And we were there a fortnight. That's how brilliantly doings were. What they did, they put took turns, put in a detachment, because there's six mortars in three sections, and it's put a section to cover the route out if we needed. So we went in this, it was our turn, we went down the road to this place, little hamlet as it were, and there's nobody there, totally devoid of people. And comical, but Korean, perhaps as primitive they may be, but warm they are, because they've got a kitchen at one end and a chimney at the other end. And you lit a fire, and the bottom of the floor is slabs of stone covered with earth and that, you know. But all the slabs of stone get warm. Consequently, they keep warm. And we thought,